This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Military Dreams and the Deep Sea Mind, a screening and discussion with historian of science D. Graham Burnett and anthropologist of science Laurel Breitman. It took place on May 15th, 2010.
That Laurel Breitman found time to join us, and she and I'll be talking a little bit after the film. So the plan, if the audio visual system cooperates, will be for me to take maybe 5 or 10 minutes and talk a little bit about the occasion for this screening, and then show a pair, again, God willing, of short films. One is a 5 to 10 minute newsreel from 1960 that shows Navy work with dolphins at the very origin of the Navy Marine Mammal Program. And then the second film is really a Navy propaganda film shot in 1963 featuring Glenn Ford as the narrator, Otto Lang as director, and it runs about 30, 35 minutes. And it's a propaganda film that promoted the Navy's Marine Mammal Program before it was basically pushed underground by kind of changing ideas about marine mammals in the mid-1960s. So that's, and that's part of the story. So what I thought I'd do to get us set up is not just thank Cabinet for giving us the venue, but also thank our kind of co-hosts, Orion Magazine. The sort of proximate occasion for this gathering is a piece I have in the current issue of Orion on John C. Lilly, John Cunningham Lilly, and dolphins in the American imagination since 1955. And Orion very graciously sent a bunch of magazines down, so when we're mixing and mingling afterwards, feel free to take one. Thanks to Jennifer Son, the editor up there, for doing that. And we have the photo editor maybe in the house. He's en route if he's not here yet. So let me tell you a little bit about what this piece tries to do. It's clipped out and reimagined, in a sense, from a chapter of a long and tragically turgid academic book that I won't press on any of you that deals with changing scientific ideas about whales and dolphins across the 20th century, sort of from the origin of modern whaling to save the whales, global counterculture organized around environmental protection of this particular taxon. And there's a chapter in there that talks about dolphins in this critical moment in the 1960s. The magazine version of the piece begins in San Diego. For those of you who are from Southern California, this will be a familiar picture. This is Point Loma. This is San Diego. And it begins by setting up the kind of problem of dolphin representation as two sides of Point Loma, because that sort of hieroglyph up there is Mission Bay. Any people from San Diego actually here? I don't want to get geography wrong. So Mission Bay up there, and that's the location of SeaWorld. And right here is actually the location of the Navy's Marine Mammal Training Program. So top of Point Loma, this sort of image of Tursiops truncatus, our soulful, intelligent, erotically liberated, playful alter egos in the world's oceans. Drop down to the other side here, where I'm doing a tight on the set of holding ponds for the 65 or 70 marine mammals that remain as Navy animals. So those are trained animals. They're involved primarily in perimeter maintenance around Navy bases at two locations, one in Georgia and one in up near Seattle. And then a cohort of them do minesweeping. They've been deployed in both Gulf Wars. This is a wire service photograph of a deployment in 2002 in the Persian Gulf. So the central problem of the piece is to try to make sense of this extremely, I think at any rate, dichotomous conception of these animals. On the one hand, the SeaWorld vision of the creatures, on the other, this cyborg conception of the animals as sort of the watchdogs of the Navy's underwater missions. And the claim I make in the piece is that those apparently radically dichotomous conceptions of the animal, in fact, can be traced down to a common genealogical origin in this guy, who may be familiar to many of you. John C. Lilly was a pioneering neurophysiologist who did his medical degree after doing a degree in physics at Caltech. He did his medical degree at Penn and at Dartmouth, worked in the Naval and Air Force avionics during the Second World War as a kind of right stuff aviator guy, real-time monitoring of the physiological systems of American airmen in the late 40s, and then by the 1950s is doing pioneering work in cortical mapping. So cutting open brains, delivering little electric shocks to different places of those brains, seeing what kinds of physiological responses you get. In the mid-1950s, he gets very interested in dolphins, having spent most of his career working on macaques, on monkeys. And part of what happens in this moment is with the discovery of Terciops truncatus, the bottlenose dolphin's extraordinary sonar capabilities. So the fact that these animals can actually distinguish between, you know, a BB made of nickel and a BB made of copper at sort of 25 feet underwater in total darkness. This kind of stuff got the Navy extremely excited in the late 50s and early 60s. And there was a little burst of naval work around these animals. This is a set of images developing a theory extremely popular in the period, subsequently disputed, possibly enjoying currently a kind of renaissance, that the melon on Terciops truncatus, the front part of the head, serves as an acoustic lens, permitting them to focus and then expand back out the generation of their sonar clicks. And this was a complete and total fantasy at this moment of bionics in the early 1960s. This just, again, gives you a feel for work that Lilly was only indirectly involved with in this period. But this is actually a porpoise cadaver strapped into place at the bottom of a stereotactic frame that you would actually put out into the waters of near Point Magoo. This is the clearest image of the thing. This is the stereotactic frame in the water. They'd actually implanted a sonar sound-producing device in the kind of where they thought the clicks were generated in the blowhole of the animal, and then they wanted to map the sonar field as it was generated, so they did these kinds of radial maps of the sonar field and so forth. Into this world of Navy interest in these animals comes Lilly with an increasingly obsessive set of questions about communication. In 1958, he's doing listening work and cortical mapping work on these animals at the Marine Studios in Florida, which were basically a place for filming B movies like Creature from the Black Lagoon or whatever, that doubled as a kind of early sea park. So this was a park where basically you're using it as a soundstage for shooting movies, but they figured out they could actually make more money by letting tourists come and hang out with the animals than they could using it consistently as a stage. Lilly goes down there to do work on the animals' sound capacities, and he believes that the animals are trying to communicate with him. He sets up a switch that permits them to turn off the rising electrical stimulation of a pain center in their brain, and he feels that the dolphins respond faster than macaques, and he comes to believe that they are trying to emulate his speech in the laboratory. Now, it's a complicated story I can't do all of for you. It's worth saying that, you know, this is the moment of Flipper, right? 1963, Ivan Tors's Flipper film comes out. Ivan Tors and Lilly were hanging out in Florida. The Hungarian emigre director not only took Lilly on as an advisor in the production of the film in the early 60s, but then he returned considerable sums of money in support of Lilly's scientific enterprise after Lilly leaves the periphery of the Cold War sciences of mind and behavior in the US government in the early 60s and sets up an independent laboratory. That Cold War sciences of mind and behavior returns us to probably the weirdest and ooziest, swamp out of which the Lilly story grows, because Lilly's work at the National Institutes of Mental Health in the late 50s, at the same time that he's getting interested in dolphins, is primarily for its Manchurian candidate era studies of the sort of psychological coherence and resilience of the human subject. He is investigating isolation tanks. So these are systems for testing American airmen and later astronauts to see how long they can survive suspended in a tank of warm water, naked, deprived of any sensory input. All this kind of work is about breaking through, breaking into recalcitrant, read Chinese or Soviet, agents that you might get your hands on. And what is really strange, and what I rehearse in the essay about Lilly's work with dolphins in the early 60s, is that he basically sequences through, I can show that he basically sequences through the set of techniques that he had learned for breaking through to an enemy agent. He uses them in his effort to break through to the dolphins. So he tries isolation, he tries chronic contact, where you put an agent in intimate contact for a long period of time, preferably with someone of the opposite sex. These were some of the more notorious experiments that were undertaken at the laboratory that Lilly built in the Caribbean with support from NASA, which was interested in these techniques, right, for the possibility of extraterrestrial communication, another part of the story we won't try to do justice to quite yet, and the Office of Naval Research, ONR, who helped him build this facility. This facility, for people who are interested in architecture, the ruins of it survive, or at least they did 3 years ago when I went down to visit. It had been hit by a hurricane and badly damaged in the endgame of the Lilly story. But it's a phenomenal structure. This is the dolphin pool down underwater, down in the sort of garage, if you like. This is connected to the open ocean, but walled off by little dam-like floodlets on the front and the back, so it gets circulation. And then there's literally the dolphin elevator, so that the sling lowers down into the water. The dolphins can swim in, and then they get brought up into the upper house. And for the chronic contact experiments, Lilly actually flooded the entire upstairs of this building so that over what was ultimately a period of more than a month, a young woman named Margaret Howe, dressed in spandex, ran this set of sort of linguistic exercises to try to communicate with a male dolphin. And notoriously, again, I assume some of you know this story, some of you may not, Lilly's write-up of this material, which comes out in 1966-67, actually includes a discussion of the success of these experiments, exemplified by, in some sense, the oldest form of human-animal contact. The argument is that they ultimately have an erotic contact, and it's that proves that they've been able to kind of commensurate each other, which gives rise to several fictional treatments subsequently. The most notorious transfer of these techniques of Cold War mind and behavior science across to this periphery of animal behavior work in this period is the transfer of LSD-25, which Lilly, probably many of you will know that drug was being used legally only by researchers with government clearance in veterans' hospitals as an aid to psychotherapy. It was thought to reduce inhibitions and enhance one's capacity to get access to the parts of oneself that would otherwise be suppressed or repressed. It was also experimented with by the CIA, both with the knowledge of their own officers and in several notorious cases without the knowledge of the officers who were Mickey'd, in a sense, to sort of see how they would hold up being shanghaied with an exposure to LSD, on the grounds that agents needed to be prepared for that kind of thing when they were operating overseas. Lilly drops acid for the first time, not using his stash, which he gets for Veterans Hospital work through the National Institutes of Mental Health, but actually with Ivan Tors's wife. Remember Ivan Tors, the producer of Flipper? She was, Constantine Tors was a kind of West Coast guru, 62, who introduced a number of folks in the Valley to the drug, and Lilly takes it with her in 63, has a very good trip, subsequently has a bad trip in New York, but is sufficiently interested in these experiences that he comes to believe that they could be of considerable importance in helping him commensurate his capacities to those of the dolphin. And in the incandescent endgame of the Communications Research Institute laboratory, he takes LSD while floating in one of those flotation tanks and gives LSD to the dolphins in the flooded structure, all the while hooked up by this fantastic network of stereophonic listening system between the tank and his own person. And it's under these kind of conditions that I think you can clearly see Lilly having, you know, very much crossed over from that world of the Cold War spooks and the foundation of the Navy Marine Mammal Program, where he plays an integral part in the early 60s, over to what, you know, becomes a kind of Pied Piper role in the counterculture and the kind of reimagining of these animals as alternate intelligences that can tell us about our inner lives and about a possible new relationship to nature. And that's where he ends up. Definitely loses his security clearance about that time. Navy funding, snip, snip, snip. NSF takes back his grant. The Office of Naval Research takes back his computer. They'd given him one of the very earliest computing systems to do signal processing on the phonations of the animals. All that gets retracted. He ends up out at Esalen on the West Coast, you know, leading a very different kind of life into the early 70s. So there's a lot to talk about there. What I'm going to show, and then we'll turn back to conversation on this and the Navy Marine Mammal stuff, what I'm going to try to show are a pair of these films that are really from the origin point of the Navy's Marine Mammal Program. So this is actually, Lilly will not be discussed in the stuff you're going to see, but these are the people who had been inspired by Lilly. In the archives in Stanford University, where Lilly's papers are kept, I was able to discover a whole bunch of correspondence between Lilly and these scientists, some of whom you're going to see now, who were involved in this early work. So, Sina, I'm going to switch over, and let's see if we can make this happen. Okay. Well, I'm really sorry about the sound problems, but I hope you were able to get some sense of things. Maybe you bring up the house lights. And what I would hope to do now is maybe just sort of talk. See, first, Laurel, if you have thoughts.
That should work now. Great. Those films are amazing and funny and sad and I think indicative of this long, complicated relationship that humans have had with cetaceans since we started discovering each other. Something that I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about, and it's hard because I know not everyone has read the article, but I've certainly read the article, and I hope everyone gets to read it. It's really lovely. One thing I'd love to chat about a little bit is that this work is part of a long, rich, disturbing, interesting history of humans enlisting other animals to fight humans. Spanish dogs during the conquest of the Americas, war elephants owned by the kings of Siam, horses in so many different wars. And today, dogs at checkpoints, dogs in torture, dogs as sniffers. And so I think there's something really interesting going on when we enlist other animals. And I don't think that the dolphin work is exemplary in the institutions who were doing the enlisting trying to show that these animals are choosing it. Mm-hmm. You know, this sort of like, okay, we will capture you violently in the Gulf of Mexico, and then we will retrain you completely take away your ability to echolocate or only do it when it's really painful to you. Some of that footage is just shocking. Every time those dolphins are echolocating, they're probably getting the reverberations back at them when they're in those metal tanks at such an incredible and painful level that choosing to do it because the trainers are asking them to do it is probably a really painful thing. And even today, a lot of cetaceans, captive cetaceans, are given antacids mixed in with their foods to help with the nausea and the disorientation that comes from trying to use their echolocating abilities in captivity.
Just to respond on the question of these animals and their actual roles, so there were a set of attacks on the facility that were developed by animal rights activists relatively early on. And the projects were almost totally classified by 1966-67. And by 1969-70, there was actually a mobilization in Vietnam. Again, I don't because I've been working on this stuff for so long, I'm hazy as to how much of this is sort of common knowledge and what if it isn't. But a set of Navy dolphins were deployed at Cam Ranh Bay in Vietnam from 1970-71. And that deployment has always been shrouded in a certain amount of mystery. The argument that the Navy has always made is that the dolphins were trained as part of a swimmer interdiction program aimed to stop Viet Cong sappers who had been swimming across an inland bay and blowing up bits of a fuel depot run by the Navy. And so the dolphins were mobilized in conjunction with a set of Navy officers merely to echolocate. If they sensed something that was like a intruder, they were supposed to sort of let on that they had seen something. And then they were released from a holding pen where they were being kept and sent out to tag that incomer with a flashing light. So they were equipped with a muzzle-mounted sort of bite float that they could swim out, peck a swimmer in the water, releasing the flashing light at the top of the float, and then the rest was taken care of by the Navy frogmen. So in the course of doing this, the research for the bigger chapter, which is a part, I actually went out to California and found two or three of the guys who deployed with these animals and sussed them out on what was actually involved. And they basically continued to toe that line that was what was done. If you go online and do any research on this, you'll find a vast universe of conspiracy theorizing concerning the use of the animals actually to kill intruders. And there's almost no question that those kinds of systems were experimented with. There's some images that have been released from the Soviet Union, which also had a Navy a marine mammal program, showing animals with a bite-mounted muzzle with a hypodermic syringe attached to a compressed gas cylinder. So the idea was that these things would swim up, peck a diver underwater, but in doing so drive a jolt of compressed air into the body, which, you know, kills you under any circumstances, but is especially bad when you're at depth. I asked the guys directly, one of the guys in particular, I kind of pressed on this when I was out in California, and, you know, these older guys who did Navy SEALs training in the, like, early 1960s, they retain a certain kind of glorious silence of the elect around this sort of stuff. But, you know, he did say, you might try a lot of stuff, you know, as if at this point he could almost wink at the fact that such systems were tested with. My own sense is that almost certainly they were experimented with, though I continue to doubt that they were ever actually weaponized, just because I think if you were a diver, the idea of being in the water with a wild animal that was equipped with a, you know, lethal, it would just be a kind of iffy environment. So I continue to be skeptical, although there are other folks who have argued that it was done. Whether it was done by the Soviets, you know, nobody knows. Nobody's gotten access to that stuff.
I think that there was a recently publicized sale of some of the Soviet dolphins to Iran. And I think that it was 2003, 2004, but it's recent. It was in the BBC. It was a few that I was looking forward to bring tonight to see if I could find some better sources, but that's all I got. You know, I think that dolphins often embody this kind of shadow panda politics. You know, the kind of international diplomacy of animals, these gifts. And if this is true, and if these are these kind of lethal dolphins, and that they are being sold between these two powers, I think that means very interesting things.
Just another quick anecdote about the guys working with the dolphins. One of them who. Concerning the Vietnam deployment, said something very interesting, which was that they only deployed once. That is, there was one questionable dolphin says, I see something out there. They let it go. It does lose its flasher, but by the time the frogmen find the flasher, there's nobody near it, and so it's sort of recorded as a question mark concerning whether it was a successful interdiction. And that much is in Navy propaganda stuff even now about the whole episode. What one of the guys said who deployed with them was that he actually thought they were only of modest use for sussing out sappers, but they were fantastic for keeping the Navy SEALs and frogmen alert. Right, because they were just such kind of interesting animals to hang out with, so that he had a sort of subtle sociologically inflected reading of their significance in the program, in that he said they worked wonders for morale, for keeping the guys engaged, and that they actually had a very positive effect on the interdiction program. Another of them said that part of the routine was actually to show them off to the villagers on the far side of the body of water, on the grounds that, again, this may be Navy folklore, but there was a sense that being eaten by a wild animal was especially repugnant to the people of Vietnam, Southeast Asia, who knows? I know nothing about this. I have this only from bar conversation with a former Navy guy. But they, believing this, ran sort of promenades of the animal in broad daylight, running it up and down the bay, sort of showing that they had this trained thing with a lot of teeth to sort of make a show of this kind of animal power. And then they argued, you know, they never got to try the thing because nobody wanted to swim with the animals. They were too afraid. So that was their account of the whole thing.
One thing that I think that you didn't have a chance to touch on here, but that I think is explored well in the essay, is a little bit about the circles in which John Lilly was operating. So you touched a little bit on the overlaps between Flipper and the emergence of the dolphin as this really counterculture hero and heroine of both the liberated sexuality of the 1960s and also understanding alternative intelligence, and a little bit about alternative minds that are also on this earth that might represent others. One thing that I think is really interesting is John Lilly's friendship with the young Carl Sagan. And his group that was called, I believe, the Order of the Dolphin, if that is correct. The anthropologist Anna Singh has said that human nature is an interspecies relationship. I think that's very true, and I think that we tend to define humanity by comparing ourselves to other animals. And sometimes those borders are shifty or not, and dolphins, for a very long time, have stood in as alternative intelligences for interesting reasons. one thing that I think is interesting about Carl Sagan becoming very interested in dolphins is that not only, was he interested in humanness, but he was interested in what the universe was. And that if humanness is an interspecies experience and an interspecies relationship, then so might be the nature of everything else. And I think that the other great animal exploration venture of the 20th century was space exploration. And I kept looking at these videos and thinking about the chimp videos. And if you guys haven't seen these, you should. They're all online now. And you can watch the space program's propaganda about sending the chimps into space. Yeah. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about chimps in space and dolphins and dolphins
yeah.
and oceans.
Yeah, so for Carl Sagan goes down to that flooded facility that I showed in the opening conversation in 63. He alleges in his memoir that it is he who meets and picks up Margaret Howe, who's serving as the hostess in a resort in Charlotte Amalie, and that it's he who brings her back. She becomes the experimental subject who cohabits with the dolphins, right? So if you want a kind of part of the story of what happens to that facility is this crazy arc between its founding, when it's presented as a kind of Swiss Family Robinson story of Lily setting up there with his wife and their kids to do research on the animals, Lily then having a divorce by 62, he's basically left by himself in the facility going back and forth to Miami. And the place becomes this kind of hangout spot for Gregory Bateson, for Aldous Huxley, who comes out, and kind of all the hipsters. Frank Drake, the SETI intelligence guy, the guy who works on radio astronomy, also makes a trip down. And it becomes like kind of Blue Lagoon, right? It's come down, see my dolphins, hang out, girls, the Virgin Islands. And so there is this kind of strange erotic arc to the Communications Research Institute between 61 and its founding and 63, 64. And Sagan is a part of that, as is Bateson, who had at that point just remarried his fourth wife, who was almost 35 years his junior. So he was there, she was there when Lily actually heads back and loses his grants. Bateson takes over the facility and stays there full time for 2.5 years. So the Order of the Dolphin that Laurel brings up is this kind of semi-secret society of SETI researchers, of folks who were involved in the early radio astronomy data processing and developing the algorithms that were supposed to filter information-rich signals from outer space and sort out how they might be interpreted. And I noted that NASA was the funder, one of the funders of CRI, of the Communications Research Institute. Much of what Lilly did to pitch dolphins in this period to the military was to claim that they could be a model organism for interspecies communication. And this fit hand in glove with the Navy's central preoccupations of this moment. Why? Because in 1958, the Navy actually loses the contracts for the life support systems for the space race. So major initiative of this point, and this is coming back to your space story of this moment, major research initiative of this moment, obviously the space race, manned space flight. Navy thinks that it ought to be the leading research force in the creation of the life support systems. Why? Well, they've specialized in pressurized life support systems under adverse environments for 35 or 40 years at this point. Air Force wins those contracts, and Navy undergoes a kind of crisis in the late 50s when they feel like the whole universe is focused on outer space. And so they actually explicitly try to rebrand the oceans as inner space. Forget about that, you know, gazillion miles away, totally irrelevant to human life. Why would we give a shit about it? No, like where we should be concentrating is right here in these vast unknown realms that are full of resources that are significant, et cetera, et cetera. That like outer space, inner space dichotomy does much to increase the viability of this bizarre image of dolphins as our kind of familiar extraterrestrials. Right, because if the ocean is metaphorically troped as our inner space against outer space, then it too must have its little green men. And indeed, Lily rides that wave saying, yeah, they're here. And moreover, we'll model the techniques for breaking their linguistic code and communicating with them. And then you can just carry that whole system over if indeed you do pull in contact in the outer space. Should we, Laura, should we open the floor? What do you think?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
We'll come back. Yeah.
Both in the film and in your comments just now, what was something that was very striking to me was a sort of a lack of mention of the weapons potential, the warfighting capability potentials of understanding dolphins. And the film just presented this as, well, it's pure scientific research, intellectual curiosity. We want to understand how dolphins operate and how they travel thousands of miles in open waters. And sort of your comments were reflecting that same thing also. And I guess I'm just wondering, was that truly the case? Why would whoever it was in the Navy want to get money and spend money on scientific research into dolphins for pure scientific research without weapons or warfighting consequences?
Okay, so they kind of hint, you know, at a few moments in the film. So the initial Navy interest is not communication and it's not sonar, it's hydrodynamics. There is a sort of biophysical, what do you want to call it, an identified biophysical problem called Gray's paradox, which was an energistics problem worked out in the early 1950s that suggested that if the reported speeds of dolphins in the water were correct, there was no way to explain how their metabolic physiology would enable them to generate that horsepower. So if you just do their speed and you have something about their input and their output, food-wise, just energistically, there was a physiological paradox that they were off the curve of other organisms for ability to turn food into energy. It turned out that this was basically wrong, but it was a driving force for the Navy's initial investments in dolphin work, because they thought they might have some kind of skin, some kind of quality in their skin that changed their drag coefficient, and that would explain how it was they were able to put out energy. They weren't putting out more energy, they were just reducing resistance. So it was pure weapons research initially, hydrodynamically speaking, and that's what Noddy, the Pacific white-sided dolphin that you saw in the first newsreel and you saw briefly in the second newsreel, was brought in initially for. It's Lilly who then suggests, at about that moment that research is going on, he publishes this very popular book reporting that he believes he's communicated with the animals and that they're intelligent, and it's in that context that you're kind of off to the races with the idea that there's a communication possibility. Now, there's one other thing to say about the weaponizations of the dolphins. Some of you may know the George C. Scott film, Day of the Dolphin, which turned out to be something of a commercial disaster, but it was the film version of a novel that was a wild bestseller here in the U.S. and also in France. It was originally written in France as Un animal doué de raison, rational animal, which was the fictionalization of the showdown between Lily and Navy dolphin docs in the early 1960s, written by a guy named Robert Merle, who was friends with a French bioacoustics guy who had been at this conference where Lily gets vilified, basically, by all the Navy people who say, basically, you know, you've tuned in, you've turned on, you've dropped out, everything you say about dolphins is absurd, And Lily says, how can you guys be saying this to me? You know, I like made you, right? I mean, I was there at the founding of the Navy's Marine Mammal Program. I hope I made that clear. Like, you know, basically, the guy who built the Navy Marine Mammal Program, I didn't say this, there's a lot to say. The guy who built the Navy Marine Mammal Program was a college classmate of Lily's. His name is William B. McLean. He was the developer of the Sidewinder missile. He was a Caltech graduate. And it's he who brings Lily in the late 50s to basically get the program going. But by 64, the tow-headed dudes on the West Coast see that Lily done crossed over to the other side, and they won't have him at that point. This is made into a fiction about a bad set of Navy doctors who are training dolphins to do what? To put mines on enemy ships and blow up the world, like nuclear mines underneath ships and stuff. And Lily, the Lily figure in that novel, is like, no, I'm for peace, love, and understanding. And he sort of subverts their project by training the dolphins not to do violence to other people. And this is kind of in this, you know, another thing we haven't talked about to widen from dolphins, which you guys can see maybe I'm slightly manic on, is the like fact that what's the bestseller in like 55, also in France, comes over to the United States, Planet of the Apes. So Un animal doué de raison is basically like Planet of the Apes for water. It's a similar kind of story of war, violence, peace, understanding, interspecies communication. But some of the sort of dolphins war, dolphins peace thing and the weaponization stories comes out of this novelistic thing that happens by the late 1960s.
And just to add really briefly there, because I think we should connect this a little bit to SeaWorld, and I know you visited SeaWorld and you did a touch encounter, and we will continue talking about the military aspect. But something that I think we should make clear in this discussion is that what is so interesting about all of our very complicated touching with dolphins, like this was physical, these films we saw. The women were all over the dolphins, and the dolphins were all over the trainers. And dolphins, if you have spent any time with them, are incredibly affectionate themselves. They are affectionate with the people they like. They are fission, fusion. They're all over each other. They come and go. They're constantly touching. They're raking each other with their teeth. They're slapping each other with their tails. They're having sex. It's a party all the time. But you know what is so interesting about this military work is that it also made possible this whole other way of being with them, which are these encounter programs. Mm-hmm. And it is no accident that SeaWorld and the dolphin facility that you visited, where they are being trained for deployment in the Persian Gulf and all over the place, are in the same city. Mm. And I think that that is something that needs to be part of this conversation. And I will just say, I want you to talk a little bit. We need to address their questions too. But I really do want to talk about the touch element and the encounter part of this. And I know you did one. I've done them myself, not with dolphins, but with other animals. Yeah. And I think that that's a key part of this, and a key part of those films.
So to some extent, like just to be clear, the like heuristic of the story I've told you, which is that these are, you know, totally dichotomous sides of Point Loma. They have nothing to do with each other. It's not only belied by the genealogical point that Lily's at the origin of both these kinds of fantasies of the animals, both the bionic fantasy of the animals and the kind of erotic fantasy of the animals. They're also, it's belied as a dichotomy over the top, because there's basically like a revolving door across the point for trainers.
And trainers and vets and the whole thing.
Exactly. No, it's a very important point. So like a lot of people start out their training, they get 10 years of training in the SeaWorld environment, and they kind of want to take it to the next level, meaning work with the animals in the open ocean, which is that kind of cheeseball business, the animal comes back to us, you know, da-da-da-da-da. I mean, it is absurd, but it's not a trivial thing from the perspective of animal training to take a wild animal and to succeed in developing a relationship with it such that you can count on it under stress conditions and that you can go out into the water with it and believe that under stress conditions it's going to perform and that it's going to come back. And the people who do this kind of work are very proud of that, and they consider it stepping up, in a sense, to go and work with the animals in that sort of setting as opposed to the jump and flip sort of environment. Just a word on the touch thing, too, because I mentioned Bateson. So there's this crazy letter in the Lily archive where Bateson, who, as you know, like he's working in cybernetics at this point, he's very interested in sort of ethnology. He writes this letter in which he says to Lily, I've been thinking about these dolphins that you've been writing about a bit. This is basically kind of his letter of introduction. This is what gets him into the thing. He says, and I feel like what we're dealing with here, if you're right, is an animal with a human-sized intelligence that has evolved without hands. And without hands, they're incapable of manipulation in that sort of both the metaphorical sense of manipulating each other and in the sort of practical sense of moving things with their hands. They are fundamentally, as a result, about relationships as opposed to techniques, right? They can't make things. They're not about faber. They're instead about, like, their whole intelligence, he says, must be social. And if that's the case, their most important function will be not military work, but they'll serve as psychotherapists for us, because their kind of conception of the social will be so unbelievably rich. So you can see, again, the sort of the crossing point of these kind of strange interwoven themes from this period. On the one hand, pacifism, right? You have an animal that's non-manipulative. It doesn't do violence because it doesn't know violence. And the reciprocating kind of social camaradic intelligence of that non-interventionist character. Lily expands this into a rhetoric that you'll still find if you go online and sniff around, which is that they're transparent to each other. Their sonar permits them to see through each other's bodies, and that transparency to each other means that they cannot hide their sort of inner lives. So if you have, like, an upset stomach, you can't be like, I feel fine, because, like, the, like, other dolphins, like, sees gas in your intestines and stuff. I mean, this is all stuff that you will see in the writings of this period. And then finally, and most extravagantly, a theory that remains viable, and that current marine mammal biologists, of course, treat Lily as totally anathema. He basically killed stone dead a vast area of dolphin research because it was untouchable to say that you were doing, you know, writing a grant for dolphin communication for 25 years after Lily drops out. But you will hear marine mammal biologists currently talk about something like a collective cognitive experience that dolphins have in when they're working as a pod. They hunt collectively, and they can all hear each other's echolocations simultaneously. So they're all putting out, and they're all taking back in, which means everybody can, in some sense, maybe, who knows, see what everybody else is seeing. And the question of sort of what the affective cum cognitive quality, what the qualia is of all having the same intellectual experience of the environment together as a signal processing problem is the kind of thing that they still kind of get excited about in you know, marine mammal science discussions. And Lily was one of the people who, of course, mobilized that as an account of a sort of, not telepathic, but, you know, let's all be on the same vibe, right? I mean, that's very much where this goes. There's a question.
I have three questions. Did anyone try to create a kamikaze dolphin? Number two, what have we actually learned since these films have been made, which has been 40 or 50 years? And number three, has anyone admitted to dating a dolphin?
So I'll do, you know, one for sure, two and a half. Do you know anything about three? I'm not sure about three. No. Okay. There is almost nothing that a creative person can come up with that wasn't at some point on paper in the kind of military-industrial universe of the late 1950s and 1960s. So, I mean, I haven't seen that document, but yes, I'm sure somebody wrote it up. Because these guys were like, they're just tons of really bright, energetic people who did nothing for, like, you know, 15 years but try to come up with ideas for how to, like, you know, kill the bad guys. And I have seen stuff that's way weirder than that. I mean, my eyes were like this on the table of the archive, where I discovered a file of a set of finally declassified work to implant radio-controlled electrodes in the brains of sharks that would permit you to steer them remotely right and left. right?
That's
so it's
going
like,
on today with MOVS and nanosensors,
yeah,
funded by the Defense Department.
But I didn't know that, but let's put it this way. These guys, it was a very primitive apparatus, and all they wanted to do basically was, you know, scare the bejesus out of Soviet frogmen. They were like, this would be so badass. Can you imagine having a remote-controlled shark? So, I mean, it's just there. I mean, there's this miserable nurse shark, you know, with, like, wires sticking out of its brain. And, you know, boof. So sure, somebody definitely tried it. I haven't seen it, but yes.
And the nuclear submarine became much more lethal. I mean, yeah. I think that's the big question, right? Like, yes, we could do this. We could make dolphins kill people. But I think that at that same time, you were seeing an evolution of the technology of war that made some of these questions just completely passé.
That's kind of interesting. You know, I'd never thought of it that way, because we tend to think of this as all sort of tendrils of this terrifying Leviathan. But when you put it that way, it's actually more like this kind of quaint handcraft. It's like the end. You know, it's like the end of the age of handcraft, really. It is, because these were genuine scientists who were genuinely like doing implanting of the electrodes.
Dolphin by dolphin.
There's a kind of a piecework quality and a kind of garage-like quality to a lot of it that sort of saves it from one register under which we might recall it. So yeah, what we know about them now, I mean, it's just a huge. I mean, it's just an enormous. It's a universe of difference. That guy, the doctor you saw in the white coat, Sam Ridgway, I've done 3 or 4 oral histories with him. He's still alive. He's sort of just about, you know, may not live out the year. He's quite sick. But an amazing guy. And he's still considered sort of the dean of tersiops veterinary work. You know, he's esteemed every place. There are a host of people like Lou Herman in Texas at Texas A&M who've done work on their communication capacities. There's Diane, what's her name, here at CUNY, who also has done, Diane Reese or Rice, I don't know how she pronounces it, who's also done significant work, including a piece recently in Science on self-recognition in dolphins. And you keep track of the current stuff because you're more an anthropologist of science. I mean, I'm really a historian, so while I'm interested in the contemporary stuff, I don't try to stay up on the literature exactly. The question of their linguistic capacities remains a little open. The animals have dialects, yes, but I mean, I was shocked to discover that Diane Rice is just finishing a paper on the distress call of the bottlenose. Lilly's most famous early paper was a paper in Science identifying a specific sort of phonemic trace recorded with one of these early sound spectrograph systems that he believed he could correlate to a behavioral phenomenon where the animals would try to help each other or would express concern, epimeletic behavior, caregiving behavior. Very hotly disputed. In fact, the showdown with the Navy scientists I described happening at a conference was over that data and whether Lilly had interpreted it correctly. Diana Rice is currently kind of trying to resurrect Lilly's claims about the distress call, but that suggests that at least on the linguistic side of things, things have not proceeded very fast. But you may tell me different.
I think it's hard to know. I think they have so many different ways of communicating with one another. We have, you know, spoken language, and maybe, you know, we, as humans, we are able to understand people's physical body language, some of us better than others, those of us who work in scientific institutions maybe less better than others. But one thing that's really interesting about dolphins is that they have, you know, what we would consider language through the echolocation clicks, also through what to us is more like the oral language, which is those squeaks and like belchy, grunty sounds. And they have a really complicated physical language. And so that, from a linguistics point of view, and I'm not a cetologist, you know, I am a historian and anthropologist, so I'm like deep in the audience looking at this stuff unfolding, but it's so complicated about where to start. And actually, just last week, I'm particularly interested in stress and in abnormal behaviors and trying to understand the limits of mental experience in cetaceans. And in order to visit one particular project, I did a swim with wild dolphins program last week off of the Big Island of Hawaii, and part of the interviews that I were doing were with the women, the young women who are the guides, who go out on the boats every day. And this is a really argued about phenomena, because the dolphins in the Hawaiian Islands, they hunt at night, and they come in the mornings to rest in the bay, so they're really tired. And this is, you know, when they're being affectionate with each other, they're sleeping. But dolphins, as you mentioned, they're not autonomic air breathers like us. They have to decide when to take breaths. So they sleep with one eye open, literally, and one eye closed, and they hang, but moving along the ocean floor, and then they come up every couple minutes to take breaths. And they look sleepy. They're not jumping. And these were spinners, who normally, when they're awake and feeling playful, are playful. You can tell they're awake. But so what's happened is there's a huge industry now about people who pay around $100, and they go out and swim with the dolphins for maybe a half an hour, 45 minutes, if they can find them, and the dolphins are sleeping. And sometimes they're playing and sometimes they're not. But you have to be really careful. You can get very close to a sleeping dolphin. And they have gotten used to people being there. But there's much debate about whether or not this is really good for the dolphins. When I went, there was only 4 people on my boat. It was low season. And so there was about 200 dolphins and 4 of us. I mean, they really didn't notice me, you know, and I was so like, God, pay attention, you know, play with me. Like, you know, it's so overwhelming to be in the water with 200 dolphins who are kind of checking you out. And they were too busy playing with kelp and discarded potato chip bags, playing catch. But this is a long story. What I'm trying to get at is the interviews that I had with the women who take these people out to swim with them. And there is maybe no one else who spends more time, actually, with wild dolphins. Every day, for at least 6 years, the girls on this boat take tourists out. They get in the water. They know all the dolphins. The dolphins know them. And, you know, I was asking them questions like, how do you know when it's too much? Like, how do you know when you are close to a dolphin that doesn't want to be with you? Because, you know, there has been a few occasions, I think, of aggressiveness on the part of the dolphins. And she said, you know, it's an uh-oh feeling. She's like, we all think this. And I talked to a number of people. They were like, you know, you just know. All of a sudden, you get a terrible feeling in your gut that you are too close. You need to back up. She's like, I can't explain it. You know, it is a physical feeling. I know that I have trespassed something. You know, and I don't know what to make of this. You know, this is not something that's provable inside of a laboratory, but it's something that is certainly agreed upon and is kind of how you figure out how to approach someone at a party. You know, you kind of know when you go up to someone whether or not they actually want to talk to you or not. And it's not because you've asked them. You know, so this is not so weird when we think about human-on-human interactions. Where it becomes interesting in terms of, you know, how we understand cetacean behavior and communication is that it's impossible to prove. And I think those are some of the more interesting areas of contemporary science. And these questions that in very early stages, Lilly was really interested in say the 60s. He was very open-minded to this stuff. The problem was that, yes, I mean, he did kill a whole bunch of this because he was so nutty, you know, and he was encouraging his staff, you know, to have sexual congress with the dolphins. To answer your question about dating
dolphins. Question three.
Yeah, question three.
Nice segue.
That's a long segue, but is, you know, I was thinking and, you know, trying to think of questions for you for this talk. This is a really Western scientific story. And in many, many cultures around the world and many groups of people, these questions of dolphins being a kind of person are really old. And dolphins being sexually interesting are old. And if you look at any good ethnographic work from the Amazon basin, for example, where the Pink River dolphins have long been, there are really transparent understandings and porous borders between women and dolphins. And dolphins seen as being able to come out of the water and impregnate women and giving rise to babies that are half dolphin or half human. And in the Hawaiian Islands also, dolphins are still revered. And that's something that cetologists there are having massive problems with when they try and deal with strandings and do dissection and do the kind of work that Lily was doing in the beginning. You know, the implanting of electrodes and all of these things. I'll just wrap up this thought.
Yeah, no.
But I think one interesting thing is that we're seeing a mega shift right now. At the recent American Academy for the Advancement of Science meeting, which is one of the biggest scientific meetings in the U.S., just a month or two ago, there was a panel about whether or not dolphins should be considered persons. And it was some of the leading neuroscientists who look at dolphins and other animals, and it was a presentation about whether or not we should be granting them rights as persons. And I think this is a really interesting connection to your work, because this is a wholesale shift from thinking about them as aliens to actually how do we make an alien a person.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And Lilly, again, was active when he came back to dolphin work. He, you know, built a group called Cetacean Nation that was about the extension of rights and all this kind of stuff. And so, yeah, this is all absolutely there. And the erotics of it actually were early discovered. So McBride and Hebb, one of the earliest publications when SeaWorld, when the marine studios in Florida succeeded in keeping dolphins in captivity, I said this when we were... Are Matteo and Hilario still here? Yeah, so these, we did a talk at Art in General. Matteo and Hilario have a great show there on kind of a set of interventions they've done at the New York Aquarium. And it's a set of kind of conceptual art pieces based on Cousteau. And we were talking about some of this underwater world stuff in this moment in the late 50s and 60s last week. And I mentioned this. One of the most shocking early discoveries about holding tersiops in captivity was that actually it was not family entertainment, because you couldn't keep certain other kinds of animals with them because the males would screw them to death. Yeah. Sea turtles. Sea turtles. They tried putting sea turtles at marine studios. They're like, the kids are going to love this. And they put the green turtles in with a male tersiops. And, you know, the tersiops are extremely bored, as has already been discussed. One doubts they do this in the wild. But in captivity, they did in one of the green turtles by, you know, finding the sort of sweetmeat between its shells, which was like, you know, I'll close the dolphin tank. Close the dolphin tank, we have a problem. So, their kind of randiness was one of the first things that was noticed about them. And there is something slightly pathetic, I have to say, about Lily's correspondence with Margaret Howe in the sort of end game of the Communications Research Institute, where he tries to sort of, you can feel him, in my view, Margaret and I have discussed this. Margaret is a terrific person, and she, I think it's fair to say, kind of went underground for quite a while because there were enough weirdos who were aware of the episode with her and the dolphin who kind of stayed after and stuff. So she kept pretty low profile for a long time. But David Rothenberg first found her, and I was able to get in touch with her as well and talk with her a little bit about the experience. My own reading, she has a very active sense of her role in that research program and felt that Lily was always totally autistic with the animals, afraid of them, unwilling to be in the water with them, whereas she was sensitive and able to use that sensitivity and intelligence to access them in a different way. She owns that narrative. I have a slightly different reading in that, you know, she was a much younger woman. She did not have an advanced degree in the sciences. And Lily, in his correspondence, made her the kind of linchpin of the success of the project. They needed results, and this notion of a kind of erotic commensuration, that the animal would sort of calm itself to be satisfied by her manually, this was like his result by 66. That was all he could point to as an example of human-animal intimacy or kind of communication, if you like.
I was thinking about the rhetoric of the films that we saw, and particularly the first one, which seemed to me was produced for a wider audience. I may be wrong.
Yeah.
So it could probably be more better typified as propaganda or, you know, propagandistic. The presentation of both the, you know, slow cumulative accumulation of data, experimentation on the dolphins, and then the sort of real prospects of harnessing their powers, and then holding out a sort of more sort of long-term fantasy of a kind of merging with the evocation of the sort of dolphin-shaped vessels and the, like, strange infusion of human blood with dolphin blood, which, you know, I don't know if the scientists themselves would have even, you know, really presented that as a real possibility, but was presented there in what was, you know, maybe you would agree, was kind of a mixing of the bionic and the erotic sort of
absolutely
veins, because it's, you know, kind of a propagandistic venue. But I guess my question is drawing those that back. I mean, this is sort of a big question, but since you're a historian, I wanted to broach it. Do you see those two veins as having something that about them that is something like timeless about them? You know, going back to Romulus and Remus, or something about our approach to fantasies, of harnessing or merging with animals, or do you see something very historical about it as developing from New Atlantis or something more modern?
Yeah. Yeah, so Jorian, it's an interesting question. I mean, I'm such a historian that, I just completely freeze up when one starts to talk, when one starts to even suggest the possibility of sort of trans-historical kind of mythemes or something for the way humans, say, and animals approach each other, like a kind of structural account, that there's some kind of a dialectical thing there, and then you go to a specific historical moment and you watch it work, a kind of harness it versus merge with it. And I mean, you know me well enough to know that, though I can understand how one might approach the world with those kinds of kind of patterned trans-historical conceptions, it's just radically at odds with my whole worldview. I just don't work that way. Which is to say, it's really a kind of a pathetic limitation, finally, of historians, I think, in some way. I mean, this is a methodological question that we could take up. It's very hard for me to see the phenomena that are being played out here in terms of, say, deep essential human drives or preoccupations that transcend the historical moment and the cultural context. Go, yeah. You're the anthropologist.
I mean, I'm very specific. This is going to be an answer to your question at just the 2-foot level, because I too am really uncomfortable. I can't even talk about animals. I can't even talk about dolphins. I have to talk about Dusty the dolphin, because they have personalities and because they're individual. And so I think that's this whole other level that makes this stuff tough. But one thing, I spent a lot of time trying to think about why dolphins. What is it about them? Why are they a cliche lower back tattoo? Why? Why are they on onesies for kids and yet also these sexual emblems? And what is it about dolphins? I think that they are just a lightning rod. I think they're a lightning rod for spiritualists. I think they're a lightning rod for historians. I think they're a lightning rod for scientists. They're sexy. A good friend of mine is Toni Frohoff. She's a cetologist. She studies the phenomenon of solitary, sociable dolphins and whales. These creatures who have come unglued from their pod in some way and who have attached themselves to a group of humans, either particular or humans this species, and are social with them. For me, I think what's so interesting is that as a human, they seem full of contradictions. And sometimes that's puzzling and makes you curious and want to know more. They always look like they're smiling, even when they're not. For example, they look happy and they're not, and we don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. Next to us, they, and I think, we can't really do brain comparisons, but, the brains of toothed whales and dolphins, they're larger than the other primates, even, in comparison to body size, in respect to body size. They're super intelligent, they're hypersexual, but they're also popular cartoon characters. I mean, I think these things, and unlike chimpanzees or rhesus monkeys or macaques, we haven't made them into good proxies for humans 100%.
Yeah.
I think those creatures, even dogs and rabbits, they have worn well beaten tracks into our laboratories, into our testing facilities, and dolphins haven't really.
Yeah.
They are still the hot girl at the party, that we want to be around.
So, Clifford, I mean, one version of an answer to this is to say, there's an enormous anthropological literature on totemism, which is, has been worked as a vein for thinking about these moments of something like convergence or symbolic self-referentiality through other. And, it went through a phase of being a way of talking about primitive Africans, and it evolved into some quite sophisticated structuralist thinking in the 20th century. And then you come out with someone like Clifford Geertz, who, you know, who's left those sort of accounts of totemism behind, but still is going to give you that wonderful line so often quoted, right? You know, animals are good to think. And, you know, what he, the very kind of violence to grammar in that line, it's not, you know, animals are good to think with, it's animals are good to think.
Like eating. It sounds like eating.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, are you thinking in them? Are they thinking in you? Or, you know, so he keeps some of the weirdness that you're referencing just in the kind of poetry of that line. And to say just one more thing about your this dolphins apes thing. You know, I just wrote the conclusion of the big academic book of which this is a part, and one of the things I tried to do in that conclusion is to, as many of you probably know, Donna Haraway's great book Primate Visions, a book about the scientific study of primates in the 20th century and the way we fantasized everything from motherhood to eros to civilization sort of through these creatures. Brilliant, important book, one of the most important books in our field in the in the last 100 years. And I really tried to say, you know, look, dolphins, if monkeys were a way of thinking about our similarity to the animal world, there's a way in which the marine mammals are an occasion for thinking about alterity. And so, you know, in a very alterity, difference as opposed to sameness. So, you know, the monkeys are the model of us, and they're just not right. Dolphins are, like, totally wrong, but enough like us that we are made alien to ourselves. Now, I don't want to overplay this, because obviously there's an element of alterity present in the ape, just like there much of what we've talked about is similitude. But the vectors are, in some sense, it seems to me, reversed. The mirroring that we get from monkeys is uppermost in our preoccupation, and something like the non-mirroring that we get in these other creatures becomes our central preoccupation. So just a thought. They're recording. Let them, yeah.
So I wonder, does this work?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, so I wonder, when you look at, I mean, apparently this notion that they're super intelligent sticks around also within the realm of more serious scientific discourse. And when you look at cognitive ethology work on primates, non-human primates, most of the experiments implies or are basically work based on some kind of instrumental reason. You have to manipulate something, you have to figure something out, do something ultimately with hands, right? Mm-hmm. So if they can't do that, then what kind of experimentation would be going on to support this assumption that, I mean, you know, how do you explore their cognition in the first place if not through such experimental paradigms?
Their noses. The rostrum. They use the rostrum in very, I mean, I'm not being flippant, you know, but in a lot of these experiments, it's the same thing. You know, you see the gorilla experiment, and the gorilla, in order to test sharing, or the chimp experiments, whatever, they have to push a lever, and then their friend gets food, or it doesn't, or they have to push something against the fence, or a lot of the dolphin experiences have been about teaching them to hit paddles, like you saw here. You know, it's basic.
Yeah, but that, in some sense, is exactly, I think, pointing to Nick's problem,
yeah.
You know, which is that they try to you know, read them into that manipulative model. I mean,
it doesn't fit.
Right.
I mean, I think that's what you're getting
but
at.
There are other kinds of examples. I mean, you know, one of the counterexamples that occurs to me, and I'm sure you have lots too, is a very one, probably the most important article on dolphin behavior is a pretty old article done by basically a trainer who was the first person to notice that. So basically, most forms of animal training, if you're trying to bring out tricks, what you do is you wait for an animal to do some unusual behavior, and then you reinforce that behavior. So you wait, it does something creative.
And
you wait, it does some damn thing, and you're like, yeah. And you try to amplify a behavior that it has done haphazardly. And the Pryors, working in Hawaii in the early 1970s, had this kind of breakthrough experience with a dolphin where they allege, and I don't think this has ever been seriously questioned, that a dolphin figured out that what people were trying to get it to do was do something new. So he went meta on them, and it like had a breakthrough moment, and just started doing every fucking crazy thing that it could think of. Because it was like, oh, you know, you should have told me. Like, you wanted me to do like different crazy shit. Well, here. And they were like, you know, blown away by this kind of run that it did of everything different. Just, you know, different, 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 different. If that's what you want, okay, you should have said so. And there's no comparable. I mean, that is a kind of a goosebumpy paper, and it has a kind of goosebumpy resonance still in the field.
But it backs up. It backs up in long-running studies of wild populations, and it backs up in other instances in these training regimes working with other animals. I've seen gorillas do this. You know, it's so boring. It's like 20 minutes a day. And, okay, put up your right hand. Put up your left hand. Give me your foot. Turn around. Give me your butt. Okay, move this way. Now take the yellow thing. Put the yellow thing on your head. You know, it's so individual. You know, and there's one gorilla in particular in Boston. Little Joe, he's escaped a number of times, he's very creative, and he gets bored with his training, and he will come up with new tricks, you know? They'll say, okay, like, give me the yellow thing, and instead he'll, you know, put the red thing on his head and then look, you know, and be like, ha-ha. You know, I know I sound anthropomorphic, but I think we need to, as those people who spend time as behaviorists and those people who spend time thinking about them like me, you know, when we lose that ability to anthropomorphize, we are actually handicapping the behavioral sciences. Because what we have in common with dolphins who are thinking creatively about tricks and what we have in common with gorillas who are thinking creatively about tricks is the fact that we might have some of the same motivations. And I think for a long time, the behavioral sciences were so scared of that, you know, that we retreated so far back in the other way that now studies of dolphin intelligence are actually, yes, like good contemporary scientists are in some ways trying to go back to some of the crazier things that Lily did.
So, I mean, I can sense people, the cabinet chairs are comfortable, but 2 hours will basically do one in.
Cabinet
so
fever.
I feel like we probably should wind up, but this may be a good place to end. One of the crazier kind of tricks that dolphins have been seen to do, though again, they appear not really to do it because we ask them to, they just kind of do it because they seem to enjoy it. And this is an example of a kind of research that's being done now where you'll keep track of this sort of thing and try to make sense of their behavior, which is an autochthonous behavior, they just do it, is they blow bubble rings. And if you haven't watched on, you know,
oh, yeah.
I suppose we could, yeah.
And the
YouTube
catch
games. So anyway, this is, shall I, yeah, maybe I'll try that. Let me see if I can do it. Am I online? What's the network?
Cabinet.
Looks like it's locked.
Yeah. Announce the capital C, 11217.
What?
2217. Dolphin penis.
There's a lot of interesting stuff on YouTube.
All right. But, I mean, maybe. So
I can put it on and then maybe we can.
File new window. So I will do YouTube dolphin.
Oh, it comes up.
I feel like this is longer than the video that I remember seeing. Yeah, there are a bunch of them. I was just trying to get that.
Yeah. This is good.
Is this
gonna? Question number three.
Yeah, so this is like a more elaborate news report. There's just like a good 2 or 3 minute thing, but I guess we'll just let them do it. Yeah,
we can't get sound.
Yeah, we can't get sound, Joe. There we go. So is that mind-boggling or what? I mean, they literally, so what they're saying there is how they do it, and they actually set up a vortex with their fins, and then blow the ring into the vortex that they've created. That's the only way you can get a bubble like that to be sustaining. And in some of the video footage, they actually can do shit like that. And they'll they'll steer them like that and break them and toy with them in different ways.
Others.
And this is not, this is primarily not trained behavior, so this is just shit they do, you know, it's been now reinforced.
But wild dolphins do it, and wild dolphins play elaborate passing back and forth. I literally watched two dolphins play with a potato chip bag they had turned inside out so it was shiny, and they play with the reflection and passing it back. And they'll move it, like, with... You know, it's so elegantly, from rostrum to pectoral fin to tail to friend to rostrum to pectoral fin.
You see, he's steering that to keep it going, because the physics of these toroidal bubbles is, you know, it's not self-sustaining. So when they are doing that thing, they're keeping them going because they know they'll go. All right, we should wrap up so people can get some drinks. Thank you very much.